The inspiration for your next trip can start on the shelf of your local library. Coming up today on Travel with Rick Steves, rockstar librarian Nancy Pearl recommends some of her favorite titles for experiencing vicarious adventures all around the world. We'll also take time for an elegant afternoon tea as Britt Lonsdale gently walks us through what you can expect and what's expected of you at a stylish London tea room. Let's start with a closer look at home with travel writer Bill Bryson. In his book, At Home, A Short History of Private Life, Bill discovers room by room what his 1851 parsonage in small-town England can teach us about the comforts of home that we take for granted. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let's get right to that question. Room and board. I mean, it's room is obvious. What's board all about?
Well, I'd always wondered that myself. And it turns out that in medieval times, particularly in humble dwellings, the dining table was not a table itself, but it was just a board that hung on the wall. And at mealtimes, the family would get it down, and people, members of the household, would sit around, and they would balance the board on their knees and eat off that. And over time, the term board came to signify not just the dining surface, but the meal itself. And that's where we get the term room and board. That's where the board comes from. That's where boarders come from, and boarding house, and all those other terms. And even the expression above board indicates somebody, an honest person whose hands are visible at all times above board.
You can learn so much by looking at houses in your travels. I've picked up a notion that they would prepare a meal on a board in the old castles and manor houses and so on, and then walk the prepared meal into the dining room and set it down in front of the diners. Is that what you learned?
Certainly board was originally a much more basic sort of thing. Almost all household furniture was extremely basic. If you just look at a word like cupboard, I mean, the word cupboard is obviously cupboard. And we think of cupboard as a kind of cabinet that probably has a lot of, you know, very nice carpentry involved in it. But originally, a cupboard was really just a board on which cups were stood. It was a very simple piece of furnishing.
And even originally, well, sort of the fundamental of furniture is mobility, right? The French word for furniture is, if I understand correctly, mobile.
Yes, and same with Italian and I think Spanish as well. The Romance languages were based on mobility. Because in early days, it was wealthier households. The people of the sort of dominant class tend to have large households, and they moved around a lot. And so somebody might have, you know, lots and lots of land all over the place, or be off on various different kinds of campaigns. And so such furniture as they had, they wanted it to be mobile and to be able to move it around. And the whole idea of having the kind of fixed and elegant furniture that we think of now was really a much later manifestation.
Well, that's related to the concept a room fit for a king, I believe. And to be an effective king in the Middle Ages, you had to be on the road almost all the time. And noble people would have a room fit for a king, and the king would be more likely to stay with them when they were in that town.
That's absolutely the case. But through much of the Middle Ages, even the very top of the social heap, in terms of what they had, tended to be very basic. I mean, something like as simple as a chair. A chair is a fairly modern device. And again, until about the time of the 14th century, a chair was a privileged thing to sit on, which is why we still have, you know, chairman of the board and someone who runs a meeting chairs it. The person who was running the meeting, the most important person in the room, was the one person who got the chair.
You write in your book that houses are not a refuge of history. It's where history ends up. And this is a good example of that, isn't it?
Well, when we study history in school, the way we're normally taught history, it's all about grand things happening on the world stage. It's about wars and big political events and all of that kind of thing. But in fact, most of what motivates people in the wider world is to get things at home. So whatever happens in history, whatever is discovered or fought over, whatever foods are found or spices are found or new materials, fabrics and so on are found and discovered, they're brought back to one's country and they end up in the home. And so you can write a very good history of the world by just looking at the things in your house. And if you look at things like furniture or fabrics or foods, you can actually write a history of the world, a very good history of the world from that perspective. But those are the things that tend not to be featured very much in normal conventional history books.
In that regard, let's talk about the bathroom. What does that teach us about hygiene? Your house is 1851. You're living in it a century and a half later.
Well, the one thing you would have noticed in 1851 was the concept of modern hygiene was really just getting going then. This was about the time that the flushing toilet was invented, or at least the first modern practical flushing toilet was invented. Before that, of course, people had to go into privies outdoors, or into chamber pots and that kind of thing.
So did the vicar in your house in 1851, did he have a sit-down flush toilet inside, or did he go outside?
Well, it's not quite possible to tell what he had exactly. We do have the original blueprint of the house, and on the staircase, on the landing, halfway between the downstairs and upstairs, the original blueprints show a little room that's marked as WC, water closet, which would indicate that that was a room where the person in the house was expected to go to do his private business, so to speak. But whether that incorporated a flushing toilet or not isn't possible to say. And in any case, that room seems not to have been built at that time. The rooms that we have as bathrooms in the house now, one of them originally was a dressing room and another one was a bedroom. So we have like a very big bathroom, which was often the case with 19th century homes in Britain, because it's too big to be a bathroom, because originally it was actually a bedroom.
We're talking about your book At Home, A Short History of Private Life, but that reminds me of Neither Here Nor There when you talked about your backpacking trip in the 70s. I remember back in the 70s, cheap hotels in Paris had a landing halfway up the stairs, and that was where the toilet was.
Well, I'm not an architect, but there must have been some practical consideration there. Very often, the thing you have to bear in mind is that because houses are older than the bathrooms within them, very, very often, when the bathrooms came along, when people started wanting this little space for privacy, they had to put them wherever they could kind of fit them in.
That could be retrofitted. I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Bill Bryson, and Bill's new book is At Home, A Short History of Private Life. Bill, I was fascinated by how the arrangement of chairs would change over time and how that changed social interaction.
I mean, one of the things that would surprise you if you went to, let's say, Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's house, or any other house of that period, if you went there at the time that he was alive, you'd find that by day, almost all the furniture in the living rooms was pushed back against the wall, and that the middle of the room was empty, rather like a waiting room. And the reason for that was because the rooms were very dark. When you were crossing these rooms with a single candle, you'd negotiate your way around a lot of furniture because you would be constantly cracking your shins and and falling over. Houses were very, very dark at night, and so the safe way of making them safe was to try and get the furniture as much out of the way as possible. And the relic we have of that is that lots and lots of the furniture we have even now is meant to be pushed up against a wall and on a chest of drawers. The back of a chest of drawers, or the back of a wardrobe, is going to be very basic. It's not normally finished in good wood. It was the same in Jefferson's day. The back of chairs would have been very basic. It wouldn't have been finished in the good cloth that was visible on the front of the chairs, because most of the time you weren't going to be seeing it.
You know, I've always thought English have strange taste in carpets, at least from going to cheap B&Bs over the decades. What kind of floor coverings did they have back in the middle of the 19th century?
It depends very much on what class you come from. If you could afford it, you had, very fine Axminster wool carpets. But a lot of people couldn't afford that. And particularly in America, you had not only the problem that there wasn't anything produced locally, but it cost a lot of money to import these things. And so people like Washington and Jefferson and other people of that class, they often had to have much more basic coverings on their floors simply because they couldn't afford to import everything. There's a real shortage of materials right throughout the whole of the colonial period in America. It would be too much to say that frustrations over consumer goods was what led to the American Revolution, but it was actually part of the overall frustration with Britain. It was not just a political frustration, but it was a frustration of the fact that we weren't allowed to have things as cheaply and as readily as people back in Britain were.
It's that quest for a comfortable life that you learn when you study your home. I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Bill Bryson, his book, At Home, A Short History of Private Life. Bill, in your study, you must have gotten kind of close to the vicar, Thomas Marsham, right? He designed the place, actually?
He used an architect, so he didn't design it, but probably, I mean, as with most people who build their own homes, I'm sure he had a lot of input into how things went. And what's interesting in our house was that we have the original blueprints, and they show more or less the house as we've got it now, but there were a lot of very significant things changed between the house as designed and the house as built. So presumably, the Reverend Marsham was actively engaged in making adjustments as the building went up.
Now, as you toured your own home, you must have had a few moments where you were frustrated by not understanding this or that. If you could have Vicar Marsham right now and take him to a corner of your house, what would you ask him?
Well, the one thing that's the very strangest thing in the whole house, is that was kind of my starting point for the book, was that I went up in the attic of the house, and in most British homes, the attic is really quite inaccessible. It's not like a space that you would normally go up to. And I had to go up there to look for the source of a leak not long after we moved into the house. I went up there and discovered there was a door in the wall that went out onto a space, a roof space, a kind of very small flat area on the roof space, but it was a very good door. I mean, it was a proper door that leads out onto a effectively useless small space on the roof. And I would love to know what they were thinking when they built this door in the wall to go into the outside of the house in a part of the house that nobody would ever normally get to.
Now, when I read that, I just thought that's where the man of the house would go to survey his domain. Don't you think that
would be? Well, it's a very effective way of surveying the domain, but in order to get up there, you really have to do some kind of gymnastics, because there's no ladder or steps or anything that takes you up into the attic. You have to get out a very big step ladder. I mean, these ceilings in 19th century house are high, so you have to get out a really big step ladder and go right to the top of it and haul yourself through a hatch in the ceiling and then sort of clamber your way through an attic and go out this door. So by the time you get out there to survey your estate, you're going to be covered in cobwebs and pretty breathless.
You're not much of a gentleman at that point. You know, when we write travel books, I think our hope is that people will enrich their lives by experiencing things, you know, from other cultures. Is there one aspect of your study of your mid-19th century English stately home that helps you enjoy your home more today and that we might all benefit from to enjoy our lives today from what you learned back in the days of Vicar Marsham?
Well, I think that probably the basic thing, the most fundamental thing, is just how comfortable we are, how lucky we are. Just think of something like music. In his day, if he loved Beethoven, he would probably, in his whole life, he'd probably only be able to hear a particular Beethoven concerto once or twice or, you know, a couple of times in his whole life. We can get a CD or some other kind of recorded music and listen to it over and over again. And you can multiply that through every aspect of your life. We have comfort and luxury beyond the imagining of people only a couple of generations ago. And yet we take it all for granted. We really ought to stop from time to time and just reflect about the fact how lucky we are to be alive now.
It's a beautiful thought. Bill Bryson's latest book is At Home, A Short History of Private Life. Bill, thanks for joining us and best wishes with your travels and your writing and this great book.
Thank you very much, Rick. It's been my pleasure.
There's no place like home.
Next, we're off to London for a proper English afternoon tea. And then Nancy Pearl provides the inspiration for literary adventures that take you to faraway worlds. By phone, we're at 877-333-RICK, and our email is radio@ricksteves.com. It's Travel with Rick Steves.